From NPR, this is Justice Talking. I'm Margo Adler. On today's show, pornography and the law. From the courts to the streets, opponents say the government must do more to curtail pornography.
I've had personal friends whose marriages have been destroyed by pornography, who lost everything.
But passions run high on the other side of the argument, too.
Because I think more harm comes from sexual ignorance and isolation than comes from exposure to the material.
Coming up after the news. This is Justice Talking from the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg Public Policy Center. I'm Margo Adler. This program was originally recorded in December. Erotic depictions are as old as human civilization, but discomfort with sexual images has posed a challenge to governments since the printing press made pornography widely available. Today is no different, with public entities from zoning boards to the Supreme Court considering how and when to regulate pornography. Today on Justice Talking, pornography and the law. The adult film industry generates thousands of productions a year, which are widespread on the Internet. Almost all of the performances involving adults are legal under U.S. obscenity laws and protected by the Constitution's First Amendment guarantee of free speech. But the popularity of pornography troubles many. Kristen Espeland reports on a Kentucky man leading an effort to turn back the growth of pornography in his community.
There is a bully among us. The bully has many forms.
You're listening to the opening scene of a video for an anti-pornography group called Reclaim Our Culture, Kentuckiana, or ROCK. Kentuckiana is the border region between Kentucky and Indiana.
The bully wants us to believe it is just clean fun. It doesn't hurt anyone else.
In the video, images of children on swing sets and families eating dinner flash between shots of prostitutes looking for customers and a pole dancer strutting in high heels. It's a juxtaposition ROCK director Brian Wickens hopes will keep you from visiting that porn site. While he sips coffee in a busy morning bakery in southern Indiana, Wickens says he's seen how an addiction to porn can wreck lives.
I've had personal friends whose marriages have been destroyed by pornography, who lost everything. Slowly, they're drifting more and more away from their spouse, finding themselves looking at online porn for hours at a time, no longer around the kids. And then it creates this fantasy world where the wife could never meet those expectations.
That's why Wickens says his organization, ROCK, is focusing on coaching porn addicts to kick the habit, helping sex workers leave the industry, and encouraging communities to staunch the spread of sex businesses. But he's new to this cause. A couple of years ago, he was still a young partner for a large Louisville law firm litigating corporate cases. But he says another deeper concern just kept nagging at him.
As years went on, it just grew and it grew, and to the point where I really couldn't ignore it anymore. So on one hand, I'm really having a successful law career. I'm moving up the ladder. I'm becoming a partner, all the things you're supposed to do. And on the other side, it was this complete tugging of, no, there was something more.
Wickens says pornography, sex businesses, and what he calls a general decline in American values and morality had been bothering him since college. He just didn't know what to do about it. But he knew he'd found kindred spirits when he heard about ROCK, back then just a collection of concerned citizens.
People came together and saw the proliferation of sex businesses across our region. And what a lot of people don't know is that this region of the country has been stated that it's in the top five worst places when it comes to the number and cluster of sex businesses.
Wickens says that's according to a former FBI agent's assessment. So he took a first step and joined the fledgling group's board. But when the organization decided to formalize, to hire a president, he felt compelled to apply, even though it meant leaving his law practice. But now, he doesn't look back. Wicken says there are days when he wonders whether he's making a difference, but there are those other days when he's certain of his purpose. Like the moment after a talk he gave when a mother approached him. She thanked him for the work he's doing and said her 12-year-old daughter had been sexually abused by her father and an uncle. Wicken says she had tears in her eyes when she told him pornography was to blame.
And she brought that little girl over and she said, "I want you to meet Mr. Wickens. He's going to work to protect little girls like you." And I guess that's what I want to get across. This isn't about, you know, pushing an agenda on somebody else, but there are real people being harmed. There are real lives being destroyed.
Today, Rock offers help for women who want to leave the sex industry with religious counseling and connections to social services. They convene men's groups to talk about the harm pornography can cause a family, and they approach town zoning boards to ask for stricter zoning laws that limit concentrations of sex businesses. Wickens acknowledges that heading Rock has meant he and his family have had to make some sacrifices. Money may sometimes be tight. And Wickens recalls how some family members and colleagues thought he was crazy to walk away from a lucrative law practice to take a job at an unknown nonprofit.
If anybody's ever been on this kind of a journey where they have feeling really called and led to do something else with their life, you know, I think they would truly understand and know that you don't really have a choice. You know, I heard then, why would you do this to your family? You know, and my response is, well, I'm doing this for my family.
Wickens says that when he was a lawyer, one of his little girls struggled to pronounce his profession. She told her teachers her dad was a liar. Now, he says she tells teachers her dad helps protect families. For Justice Talking, I'm Kristen Espeland in Louisville, Kentucky.
Anti-porn activists like Brian Wickens hope to discourage people from accessing pornography and bring about more restrictive laws. But members of the adult film industry say there's no good reason to fight pornography.
I personally believe that greater sexual access to things is overall a general good, because I think more harm comes from sexual ignorance and isolation than comes from exposure to the material.
That's Nina Hartley. She's a registered nurse and an adult film star. Her role in Educating Nina in 1984 was her first hit. Since then, she's participated in hundreds of adult films. Hartley says her 20 years in the industry have given her some perspective on how critical attitudes toward porn are changing and how they are not.
In the beginning, of course, the religious prohibitionists were all on the moral crusade. This is an affront to God, it is adultery, et cetera, et cetera. And the anti-porn feminist crowd, or the so-called left anti-position, was that it the tool of the patriarchy, and the existence of it is de facto demeaning to women. So now, 25 years into the argument, a lot of the religious moralists are now using feminist language to speak against pornography, as well as to speak against reproductive choice and options.
Well, how do you answer the other criticisms that pornography is harmful, that people can become very addicted to it, that it can destroy marriages?
I don't believe that porn in and of itself is harmful. I do believe, speaking as a trained health professional, that the overuse of any material or activity or substance can indeed be harmful to a person or a relationship. And my personal experience as a person who has been happily married and unhappily married is no outside force can break up a happy marriage. Mm-hmm. All marriages break up internally, and the blame or the fault can be thrown out onto an outside thing. She worked too much. He used too much porn. She spent too much. He used too much of a mama's boy, et cetera, et cetera. I've discovered that there are like three main groups of people when it comes to this issue. There are people who really like adult material. They consume it, they watch it, they make it. It's important to them. Then there are people who really, really hate it. It's equally important to them, but they get no pleasure from it. And then there are the much bigger group of people for whom it's not an issue at all. They don't think about it, they don't consume it, they don't use it, they don't look at it. It's not a problem. I came into adult entertainment as an adult. I was 23 years old before I started as a dancer, and I had already had my feminist training, so I was sure to look at every instance that I was involved in from a feminist perspective.
And so how do you answer the question that feminists, that some feminists put, that say that porn is misogynist, you know, the famous Hustler magazine with the woman in the meat grinder, that it portrays women in a demeaning manner? How do you answer that argument?
First, I take a deep breath so the top of my head does not explode. First, the word misogyny has really been diluted, you know, just like the word fascist is something you throw at someone whose politics you really don't like a whole lot, instead of being aimed at people wearing brown shirts and doing the Sieg Heil salute. The word misogynist, the people who use it assume that everyone agrees upon its meaning, and that they agree that it is a bad thing. And for me, in this particular debate, the flinging around of the epithet misogynist is a different way of saying what you do really, really, really upsets me a whole lot, and I don't like it. I say, you know, actually, porn is no place for misogyny because there's too much women in it.
Is there porn out there that you wouldn't watch?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's most of it I wouldn't watch. Most of it is execrable. Because why? Because our culture is so conflicted about sexuality. We do not grant it the grace and honor I think it deserves. We don't let it be a subject of art. We let it be a subject of commerce because we are very of two minds about it. And so I do believe that the culture gets the adult material it deserves. And so we are a conflicted society that creates a massive amount of material that most of it is very poor quality.
You've said that porn is not just a commercial enterprise for you. It's also political.
It's political. It's social. It's my, you know, latent Berkeley do-goodism. I came of age in the 70s in Berkeley, California, where I was reading, before I was actually sexually active, I was reading a lot of the theory about sexuality and what did it mean and women's rights. And I was told early on, you know, take responsibility for your own pleasure, learn your body. This is when they had the consciousness-raising groups, and women would get together and look at their own cervixes and look at their own vulvas, which they'd never done before. And so this was very exciting for a young teenager to realize I could have this power over my body. I have control. Really, I do? Fantastic.
And your own contribution, what do you think that's been?
My contribution has been to help take some of the scariness away from sex and to certainly help empower people at home, men and women both, to feel more confident about sex and sexuality so they can get more pleasure out of it.
Nina Hartley has been an adult film actress for over 20 years. Thank you for coming on Justice Talking.
Thank you so much for having me.
The culture wars concerning porn have played out in feminist theory, evangelical sermons, and in grassroots organizing. They've also moved in and out of the courts. One effort to regulate pornography on the internet keeps on reappearing in different forms, but is yet to pass muster with the courts.
Nothing has changed. The government still has failed to show that this is not an unjustifiably broad suppression of free speech for adults.
And some conservative voices are now wondering if government regulation is the answer.
How does it play out to discussions of sexuality that are put out by conservative authors, but that discuss sexuality and religious concerns from a, you know, religious perspective, but discusses these issues in detail?
Today on Justice Talking, Pornography and the First Amendment. Stay with us. This is Justice Talking, the public radio show about law, justice, and American life. I'm Margo Adler. Today we're talking about pornography and the law. One of the most significant laws aimed at adult pornography involves a 10-year effort to regulate internet porn. In 1998, Congress authored the Child Online Protection Act, or COPPA, to guard against children gaining access to pornography online. But civil liberties groups raised immediate free speech objections to the law, and those groups may be gaining some newfound support. Some conservatives who once advocated for the legislation say it may not be necessary. Among them, Jay Sekulow, chief counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice, a law firm and educational organization that specializes in constitutional law. He is joining me along with Nadine Strossen, the president of the American Civil Liberties Union, to discuss the legislation. COPPA would require websites containing indecent material that is harmful to minors to verify the age of their users. Anyone violating the law could face up to $50,000 fines and jail time. The Supreme Court has weighed in on the law twice. Most recently in 2004, it sent COPPA back to the lower court, questioning whether it was the least restrictive solution to the problem. A federal judge in Philadelphia answered no to that question in 2007 and ruled that COPPA was unconstitutional. The government has appealed. Nadine, what has troubled you and the courts in some of these decisions about COPPA?
The point of the law is, as you said, Margot, to shield children from accessing certain sexually explicit material online. But given the nature of the internet, you cannot stop children from getting access to that material without also stopping adults from getting access to it. In many, many other contexts, including in the first internet censorship case the Supreme Court considered, the court has consistently said that even if we assume that there is a very important interest in shielding children, minors, from access to sexual material, it is too high a price to pay to stop adults from also getting access to that material. Basically, the Supreme Court then remanded it, sent it back to the lower court to see whether all of those technological findings that were the basis for the prior holdings were still applicable. And the lower court judge said, yes, nothing has changed. The government still has failed to show that this is not an unjustifiably broad suppression of free speech for adults. And besides, it's not even effective because the best way for parents to protect their kids is to do it on their own in their own homes at the receiving end.
Jay, your organization describes itself as dedicated to the ideal of religious freedom and freedom of speech. Many Right. argue that COPPA would violate the First Amendment, that the New York Times, for example, could be punished for publishing a story on a sex scandal, that art galleries wouldn't be able to post certain types of art online, or that health sites couldn't discuss sexually transmitted diseases, all out of fear that content could be deemed harmful to minors. You were last on our show defending an Alaskan student who was holding up a sign saying, "Bong hits for Jesus." As a defender of free speech, don't the implications of COPPA worry you?
Well, I think if they were taken out of context, you could take any statute of Congress and bring examples of which ways it could be applied in an unconstitutional manner. Now, the difficulty here with this case, and Nadine touched on this is a criminal statute. So it changes what's at play. The idea of Congress, I think, was correct, and that was, how do we protect minors from the internet pornography and obscenity that is out there in huge numbers? Now, I am the first to admit that I think anytime you start restricting access to anything, you've got to be very careful, because you are to say this is not a First Amendment case is absurd. Of course it is. But I think Congress was within its authority in trying to put forward a law that was going to protect minors simply by really doing anything that any convenience store owner would do, and that is, if you walk up to the counter at a convenience store and you ask to buy a sexually explicit magazine, sometimes they will ask for your age ID. They want to do a verification that you're over 17 years of age. That's typical. Unfortunately here, and the difficulty is, that you've got a statute that is now almost 10 years old and an internet that has changed significantly over the last 10 years. And I think the hurdle here for the government is very significant because the technology is outpacing the legislation. And that is the problem, by the way, generally, when you're dealing with the whole issue of online regulation.
I think one of the interesting facts here is that this law was passed in 1998. It has never gone into effect. So kids have been exposed to whatever online sexual material is not being prosecuted as either obscenity or child pornography, i.e. made using actual kids, or they have been shielded from that material, not because of government prosecution under these kinds of laws, but rather because of ISPs that their parents use that are specially geared toward minors, because of monitoring by their parents, because of internet filtering or blocking technology that's used either in their homes or in their schools or in the public libraries. I would say, you know, have we seen any catastrophe in terms of adverse impact of kids being exposed exposed to the dangers of the internet. I think with the passage of time, some of the initial panic that greeted the internet, which has been the panic that greets any new communications medium, oh, this is going to be so dangerous to our kids, I think that's really abated. And some of the initial proponents of the law have acknowledged that there are alternative methods of parents making the determinations about what their kids will or will not see that have been tried and true in other media and will work as well on the internet.
So, Jay, do you think that COPPA is obsolete?
Well, I think it suffers from what I've called a technological defect at this point, and that is the burden and the hurdle that the government faces in getting the court to say that COPPA is constitutional is very difficult, in part because of what Nadine said, which is that the technology has increased on the child protection side as well. I mean, there's been a lot of developments by a lot of ISPs, including some of the larger ones like AOL and others, that are trying to at least protect minors. I think saying that the parents could do this all the time is very difficult because the reality is kids are online a lot. I do get concerned, though, and I'm not saying that the congressional response is the way to handle it, by the way, but to say that there has not been a problem with online pornography, even if it doesn't reach the level of obscenity, but online pornography targeting at children, I think that misses the mark. I think there have been reports, there's been, of course, cases involving this and media reports on this where there have been issues and concern about that.
Nadine, how big is the threat of exposure to online pornography? I read one figure that says only 1% of all websites contain sexually explicit material. On the other hand, a recent study published in the Journal of Pediatrics showed that 42% of children aged 10 to 17 had been exposed to online pornography in the past year. So it would seem that although pornography is only a fraction of what's going on the internet, children are still seeing it, right?
Margo, I hate to quibble over terminology, but to quote the Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart, I cannot define it, but I know it when I see it. When you look at how broadly the definition of what the term used in COPPA is actually harmful to minors material, it is so broad that it extends to material the ACLU puts online regarding lesbian and gay sexuality, for example, or reproductive freedom. That's why we are the lead plaintiff in the case as well as the lawyer. And the Supreme Court has acknowledged that mainstream publications that touch on sexuality in even the most serious artistic and scientific contexts can still come afoul of this law. So given how broad the law is, I would say I hope 100% of kids are seeing something that comes within this law, either the ACLU website or the website of lesbian and gay bookstores or the website of the Electronic Freedom Foundation, to cite a number of our plaintiffs. And I think it's interesting that courts have never demanded any proof that there is any harm to children from seeing sexually explicit material.
Jay, your view about this, and also, what is your own position about adults' right to view porn online?
Well, I think, look, if it doesn't reach the level of criminality, the adults are adults, and they can make those kind of choices and make those kind of decisions as long as it's not reaching the level of obscenity. I do think that we have to be careful here, and I'm one, and Nadine knows this, I've always been concerned whenever you've got regulation of any source, what impact would that have on portions of the Bible? How does it play out to discussions of sexuality that are put out by conservative authors, but that discuss sexuality and religious conservatives from a, you know, religious perspective, but discusses these issues in detail?
Nadine, I've looked at pornography, and I got to tell you, most of it's boring, repetitive, gross. And you know, we're usually not talking about Allen Ginsberg's Howl or James Joyce or Lady Chatterley's Lover. You've devoted a lot of your life to this. You've written books on the subject. I want to know why I should really care that most of this material exists and that it is protected.
I would say that I've devoted my life to defending speech that is persistently attacked, and sexually oriented expression is in that category. If you look at my one book on point, Margo, you'll see illustrations of what has been attacked in through government censorship under the rubric of pornography. And it does include material from the Bible. Jay knows this is not a hypothetical. It does include classic works of art and literature. It does include works that are very important to medicine, to science, to anthropology. I hope I can show you, and I believe I can show you, examples where works that you think are positive have, in fact, been suppressed under the aegis of pornography.
Jay, my son saw his first pornography online in the third grade. He was at a friend's house. This happens a lot. You know, he has an older brother. As far as I can tell, there were no severe consequences. He's now 17. I monitor my son's internet access pretty closely. I don't see him running to pornography now as a result of the experience. So I tend to think, you know, what's the big deal? Why should I want to restrict free speech for something that doesn't really seem that earth-shaking?
I tend to take a different view than Nadine, not from a free speech standpoint, but from what is the potential harm to the minor. That's how I look at it. That's what I'm concerned about. And in a situation where you now have technology that will enable the parent to be the protector of the information the child gets, I feel a lot better about the way the internet's going than that we did 10 years ago when this legislation went forward.
Jay Sekulow is chief counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice. Nadine Strossen is the president of the American Civil Liberties Union. Thank you both so much for coming on Justice Talking.
Thank you, Marco.
Thanks for having us.
Technology that blocks the websites children can access may resolve disputes about how to regulate adult pornography on the internet. But the Supreme Court recently suggested it would take a harder line on the question of child pornography, or even virtual child pornography. Joan Biskupic covers the Supreme Court for USA Today. Welcome to Justice Talking.
Thank you, Margo.
The Supreme Court recently heard oral arguments in the case of Michael Williams, a Florida man caught in a federal sting operation. Williams was soliciting and offering child pornography in an internet chat room. He pleaded guilty to owning child pornography, but that's not the end of the story. His case made it up to the Supreme Court because he also faced charges for bragging about sexual pictures of his daughter, which didn't exist. In fact, he didn't have a daughter at all. What did Williams do, and what is the question before the court?
The question before the court revolves around a law that makes it a crime, punishable by a minimum 5 years, to advertise, promote, or solicit materials purported to depict children engaging in sex acts. And the purported is important here because what Mr. Williams is maintaining is that you don't even need to have real pornography to be charged and convicted under this law. So the key here is whether this law intended to criminalize the advertising of it, of these materials, sweep so broadly as to violate the First Amendment.
So this is what's been called pandering, right? It's a pandering law.
Right.
And the material doesn't have to even exist, and it doesn't have to be for sale.
No. In fact, the lower court that struck down the law used an example of a grandparent who might put out a notice that says, good pics of children in bed, as if it were, it could have been pornography. But for a hapless grandparent, it wouldn't have been. So the lower court said, because it doesn't criminalize someone for advertising actual materials, rather purported child pornography, it sweeps way too broadly. Now, several other groups have come into this case, free speech-oriented groups, who say this law could actually cover promotions of movies like Lolita and American Beauty because it would be promoting materials that talk about underage children engage in sexual activity when that's not really what's even in the films, just like that's not what's really in a grandparent's attachment of a picture.
And I gather that booksellers also have been worried that it could go after not only movies, but books like Lolita.
Right, because what it does is it criminalizes any kind of communication about the advertising of purported child pornography. Now, what the government says is that this law is important to dry up the market, because it's not just that the government's going after the real thing. It wants to go after anything that will fuel the market, which is a key part of the argument from the government's point of view, and one, frankly, that got the attention of the justices. Solicitor General Paul Clement stressed to the justices that the distribution of child pornography has expanded greatly because of the internet, and that even though you might have fraudulent offers to buy or sell child porn that don't have the actual material in hand, those offers nonetheless feed the market.
Mm-hmm. So when Paul Clement, the Solicitor General, made that argument representing the Bush administration in court, how did the Supreme Court justices react? I mean, I've heard that in general they seemed reluctant to invalidate the pandering provision.
That's true. Several of the justices who normally are fearful of these sorts of criminal laws sweeping too broadly took a fairly practical approach here in trying to pin down both sides, the Solicitor General of the United States and the lawyer for Michael Williams, saying, what would really happen out there? Because at one point, Richard Diaz, the lawyer for Michael Williams, talked about the enormous reach of the statute and how this could punish thought crime, so to speak. And what Paul Clement, the Solicitor General, did to counter that was to say, no, there has to be the intention on the part of either the buyer or the seller that the materials are real, that they actually exist. And more importantly, he stressed that this is going to be used to try to dry up what they assert is a very proliferating market.
Joan Biskupic covers the Supreme Court for USA Today. Thank you so much for coming back on our show.
Thank you, Margo.
Outside the courtroom, the pornography industry is feeling the heat from a section of federal law known as 2257. Porn producers say these regulations from the Department of Justice are frustrating and frightening.
It seems totally unreasonable to me that I've had to spend so much time doing something that I can't even ever know if I've done correctly, unless the FBI shows up at my door.
Also, prosecutions of adult video producers have been rare in the U.S. for a couple of decades. Coming up on Justice Talking, are the nation's obscenity laws obsolete or under-enforced? Stay with us.
Justice Talking is produced by the Annenberg Public Policy Center, a think tank at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. The program is made possible with support from the Annenberg Foundation. The foundation works to advance public well-being through improved communication. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and West Legal Ed Center, where lawyers can listen to Justice Talking for MCLE credit online at westlegaledcenter.com. And from Oxford University Press, publisher of the United States Constitution, What It Says, What It Means, A Hip Pocket Guide. The Hip Pocket Constitution is available at justicetalking.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Justice Talking has entered the blogosphere. Each day, check out a new commentary from one of our contributors who cares passionately about law and justice issues. At justicetalking.org, you can also find forums where you can weigh in on the issues we cover on Justice Talking, like the environment, criminal justice, religious freedom, and elections. Continue the debate online with other Justice Talking listeners at justicetalking.org. This is Justice Talking, where we make the connection between law and American life. I'm Margo Adler. Today, we're talking about pornography and the law. While some worry that the graphic sexual images in pornography will distort relationships between men and women, others say there's much more to fear from sexual repression and censorship. But often the producers in the sex industry make another argument. They say there are mostly small enterprises trying to run an honest business, while being unfairly targeted by opponents and policymakers who are uncomfortable with sex. That's been a chief complaint since the Federal Bureau of Investigation announced late this year that it had conducted a wave of inspections of adult video producers. The sweep came after changes to a section of federal law called 2257, which mandates record-keeping within the porn industry. Violating the law can land you in jail, and producers say the new requirements are as clear as mud. Reporter Keith Brand paid a visit to one adult video producer in Pennsylvania who is trying to stay in compliance.
In a rundown loft apartment cluttered with books, artwork, and computers in various states of repair, Al Bairn checks his website to see if there are any new orders for his videos. Al is not his real name. He likes to keep his personal and business life separate. He's also wary about inviting government scrutiny of his business. You see, Al sells adult videos.
I decided to make a video and see if anyone was interested, and I did, and they were. My videos are unusual in that they are strictly solo videos, and there's no one in them but me.
Al's solo act provides him with less than $15,000 a year, a small but not insignificant portion of his income. This has allowed him to pursue his chosen career as an artist working in different media, and his videos reflect that sensibility. In this film, cinema verite documentary style merges with the trance-inducing soundtrack.
Because I was working completely alone and outside of any ordinary filmmaking structures and had never done any filmmaking of my own before, I basically just made it up as I went along. When I make art, I tend to be conceptually oriented, and that's just the way that I've thought about the videos as well.
The United States Criminal Code has long required producers of adult videos to keep records of performers. But in 2005, the Department of Justice expanded the scope of those regulations. Now all videos and internet sites must contain the identity of the record keeper and the address where the records are kept. And the specifics of that requirement are not at all clear.
They're just incredibly complex, and the Department of Justice has not been at all forthcoming with information about what it truly means to be in compliance. And according to the regulations, if the FBI came here to inspect my records, I have to have everything cross-referenced in a particular way. I have to have it set up so that I have a list of any aliases I've ever used, a list of all of the depictions, and all those things have to be cross-referenced to each other. And if I make a mistake in that cross-referencing and don't cross-reference it correctly, according to the regulations, I can go to prison for that.
Still, many people think that's a small price to pay in order to protect underage children from exploitation by adult video producers. But industry advocates claim there have only been two reported cases of underage performers, both of whom fake their identification. Al rejects those critics who exaggerate the extent to which minors are involved in the adult industry.
The regulations are like swatting a fly with a skyscraper. The people who these regulations are aimed at, we are not going to do it because we're not dumb. We're not, I don't want to go to jail. Basically, these regulations are being used very cynically by people who I think are frustrated that because of First Amendment protections, obscenity prosecutions are very difficult. And, you know, these are mostly people who are very, very anti-sex.
Some larger producers have the resources to manage the record keeping. But according to a report from Georgetown Economic Services on the impact of the regulations, the vast majority of adult businesses are small, like Al's. Jeffrey J. Douglas is a lawyer and advocate for the adult video industry.
There are probably only a handful of companies that are in the $100 million gross range. And when the adult industry domestically is a $12 to $14 billion a year business, it tells you, unlike any other portion of the entertainment industry where there are a handful of giants that dominate everything, this is an industry of very small business.
Al Bairn says he understands the motives behind the regulations, but questions the sincerity of the regulators.
And if I felt that the regulations were actually doing something worthwhile, I would have much less trouble with it. But again, feeling personally that they're basically about harassing people and trying to stifle speech that people in the government don't like, it seems totally unreasonable to me that I've had to spend so much time doing something that I can't even ever know if I've done correctly, unless the FBI shows up at my door.
And so Al continues to keep reading up on the latest legal developments to make sure he can stay in compliance with regulations he doesn't fully understand. And while he checks his website for any further orders, he also keeps an anxious eye on his front door. For Justice Talking, I'm Keith Brand.
Industry advocates have been fighting hard against the new record-keeping requirements, and earlier this year, a federal appeals court in Ohio struck them down. Here to discuss why this fight is so important to adult video producers is Diane Duke, the executive director of the Free Speech Coalition, which lobbies for the adult entertainment industry. Welcome to Justice Talking.
Thank you.
Section 2257 was enacted in 1988 to combat child pornography. It mandates producers of sexually explicit material to keep and verify records of the names and ages of the performers. On the face of it, that seems reasonable, but your group thinks the regulations go too far. Why?
It's comparable to hitting a fly with instead of a fly swatter with a sledgehammer. We believe it goes too far because the way that they have the adult entertainment industry collect these records and hold these records is very cumbersome. For example, an owner of a producer has to not only take the identification of the performer, and we're all very happy with and have been checking identification of performers for years and years and years. But take that identification. It has to be in a separate file from any other papers included with that performer. We have to cross-reference with it with every performance she has ever done and every name that she has ever done. It has to be on a specific type of a form. Those documents have to be kept at the place of business. And the custodian of records has to be at that place of business for at least 20 hours a week between 9 and 5 in case the FBI decides they want to come by and inspect those records.
So you're saying it's a bureaucratic minefield in a sense.
It's a bureaucratic minefield, but there are additional dangers actually for folks. Well, a lot of our businesses, you think adult entertainment industry, the myth is that, you know, they're all Larry Flint million billionaires, but they're not really. Typically, it's a mom and pop organization most of the time. A lot of this is just a second job for folks.
And you also argue that the 2257 requirements are unconstitutional, and one court has agreed with your position. What's unconstitutional about them?
It's overbroad and overreaching. You know, in a good example in Hollywood, if they have questioned, you know, any kind of content that looks like it could be more adult, all they have to do is write a letter saying that they check I-9s,
the
tax
type
of
forms,
business check. Yes. They have I-9s and they check identification that way. It's assuming guilt for the adult entertainment industry. And, I think it's important that listeners understand that the adult entertainment industry is entertainment for adults by adults using adult performers. We have absolutely no interest in having underage performers in our productions.
I want to turn for a moment more broadly to obscenity and the prosecution of obscenity. Former Attorneys General John Ashcroft and Alberto Gonzalez took strong anti-porn positions, yet despite that, there haven't been many federal obscenity prosecutions for adult pornography. What's your take on that?
It's a very difficult case to prove. You have to have community standards. So the community has to agree that it is that these materials are obscene. And they're having a hard time finding that.
Coming up, we'll be talking to the head of the anti-porn group Morality and Media. The group says more than a third of the children between 10 and 17 run across pornography online accidentally. They complain about statistics that show nearly 16% of visitors to adult websites were younger than 18 years of age. That does seem troubling to me.
Adult entertainment is adult for adults. And so we see children coming across adult materials, whether it be alcohol, whether it be tobacco, whether it be, you know, as a parent of two sons, it was up to me to be a responsible parent and to talk to my kids about what's okay, what's not okay. But, you know, when you look at opening a refrigerator and seeing a beer in there, and that's adult material, it's just as easy, you know, for a kid to walk in and grab a beer out of the refrigerator. But as a parent, I talked to my kids and they understood that underage drinking was not appropriate in our house.
Do you think that the law is going in the right direction? And are there any cases out there that you think will have in the future a dramatic effect on laws affecting pornography and obscenity?
Our society has a tendency to want to regulate things that it possibly doesn't understand. And I would say that adult entertainment is seriously misunderstood. I think that we've seen some laws, we're looking at 7 states, there are bans on sex toys, on novelties. And I have to question what possible interest would the government have as to whether or not I have a vibrator. You know, that seems to me far-reaching. I cannot go into the state of Alabama and legally buy a vibrator. That seems far-reaching to me. These are choices that we have. That's the wonderful thing about this country. We have the freedom to choose. And when the government starts to pull those pieces away, it's very, very dangerous.
Diane Duke is the executive director of the Free Speech Coalition, which advocates and lobbies for the adult entertainment industry. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Margot.
While advocates for the industry talk about choice and the threat of overreaching government, Robert Peters says the government really needs to do more. Peters is president of Morality in Media, a group that pushes for enforcement of obscenity laws and fights indecency in the media. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We just spoke with Diane Duke from the Free Speech Coalition. She argues that Section 2257, which essentially requires porn producers to keep records of the names and ages of the performers, is unconstitutional. What's your reaction?
Certainly properly worded, I think a Section 2257 will clearly stand up under the Constitution. Now, one federal circuit court recently concluded that some of the language made it unconstitutional. My anticipation is that case will be appealed to the Supreme Court because other courts have upheld the law as such, except for the provisions that apply to middlemen. It seems to me clearly the people who actually produce the pornography, who have the human being in front of them, in front of the camera, they are in the best position to determine whether somebody is of age. Take it one step beyond that and apply to the law to every distributor of the pornography. At bare minimum, admittedly, it could make it difficult. Let's say a middleman wouldn't know who did produce this or would have a hard time determining who produced it. Question, should that person simply not distribute the material or distribute it without the information? My guess is that there's probably a compromise that the courts will uphold in terms of middlemen. But whether the current regulations will stand the test, I don't know.
If 2257, was wiped away, what would that do? Would that be a really bad thing? Would it really change things?
Well, I tell you, my honest opinion is that for the most part, the established pornographers, most of whom, or certainly many of whom, are in the Los Angeles area, would take reasonable steps not to have kids in their porn because they know that they would lose everything, including their freedom. Now, that doesn't mean that minors don't make it through their testing. I mean, practically speaking, I suspect unless they assign a private detective to follow up on every applicant, they'd have a pretty tough time concluding to a virtual certainty that no one under 18 has ever performed in one of our films. But my guess is that minors in terms of more established pornography businesses, that's not a major problem. When you get away from the more established businesses, my guess is that a lot of these so-called 18-year-old girls are under 18, and in some cases, the producers could care less, and they know it.
John Ashcroft and Alberto Gonzalez, both former heads of the Justice Department, were vocal in their anti-porn stances. But that hasn't led to a lot of prosecutions during the Bush administration. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think two reasons. Number one, this is an opinion. It's clearly 9/11, September 11th, changed everything in terms of what the Bush administration intended to do in
so
general.
So priorities changed.
Oh, clearly. I mean, once 9/11 came along, John Ashcroft's focus had to change.
Why do you believe there should be more prosecutions? What is it about pornography that so concerns you?
Well, I tell you, to me, pornography hurts people. And, our job is really public policy and the law. So unless I'm asked about it, I normally don't talk about my own experience with pornography, but I know from personal experience what a hold it can get on me, a person. I'll tell you, we make the statement that the number one damage that pornography causes is to marriages. Some of the pornography the guy's looking at involves teenagers and maybe younger. And in my opinion, I tell you, just the last one, this is a very controversial question, but to me, it's not controversial at all. I think the evidence is overwhelming that pornography contributes to sexual crimes against adults and children. I mean, in terms of rape and sexual exploitation of children.
And given all the pornography in the United States, do you feel sometimes like you're fighting a losing battle?
At one level, I say two things. I mean, and in my, you know, being a person of faith that with God, all things are possible. But the other part of what keeps me going is my honest belief for many reasons that most Americans, if given a choice, would rather live in a safe and decent society than one that is shaped by Larry Flint, Hugh Hefner, and 100 other top leading pornographers in L.A. and Florida and New York City. I just think that's true. I think if they're given a choice. Do you want a society where pornography is everywhere, where kids, you know, it's totally accessible to children, at least beyond a certain age? Is this the world in which you want to live? I think if most Americans were given a choice, they'd say no.
That was Robert Peters of Morality in Media. Tell us what you think about pornography and the law at justicetalking.org. Thanks for listening. Join us next week on Justice Talking. I'm Margo Adler. Justice Talking is produced by Ingrid Lakey, Cara McGurk, Jean Barron, Viet Le, Julie Meshack, and Judy Jarvis. Gary Gaiman is our webmaster. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Engineering by Audio Post Philadelphia. The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the Annenberg Public Policy Center or National Public Radio. This is NPR's Justice Talking.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. From the Kauffman Foundation, featuring the book Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism, and the Economics of Growth and Prosperity at kauffman.org. And from the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support on the web at kresge.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.